This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting, October 29th, 2008.
Do we want to just skip the reports and just let them go first?
That's what we're going to do. Can everyone make sure that they sign in on the clipboard, please? And I'll call the meeting to order. That'll be our roll call, and we're going to skip the reports and do gorge safety first because we have two visitors here who need to get to another meeting. Kathy Zoner?
I'm the deputy chief of Cornell Police. I know a lot of your faces have been in front of many of you before. I like to keep people. And I'm also a member of the Coastal Judicial Committee, which I think is really where the questions are coming from for the group. We're looking at how we can potentially increase the safety in the gorges by creating an ability to enforce where there hasn't really been one before through the judicial administrator system. Not sure how much of a briefing you want to have on it. I've got veterinarians here as well as the manager for, he's talking to Ron Swallow. He's the manager for the area. We've certainly been working with Todd quite a bit. We've tried some temporary fencing to redirect people from using a path that was really sort of makeshift and is falling apart. Also preventing people from going down and swimming in the gorges, which is really where our biggest concern is for this year. There is no swimming in the gorges. There's never been swimming in the gorges in my tenure here. The city ordinance against it, the Fall Creek Gorge, while running through the municipality of the city, and therefore enforceable, the city code, which says there's no swimming in the gorges, is enforceable by the city police. We spent some time, ourselves in the city, the attorney, looking at deeds and property ownership of the Fall Creek itself, and Cornell's property title runs out at the high water mark. Thank you. At the high water mark of the Fall Creek. So once you're in the creek, you're not technically on Cornell property, which creates a jurisdictional issue for the Cornell Police to enforce through either the JA system or through the code system or through municipal enforcement. However, if we can mimic what the city municipal code says and get it enacted into the code, the campus code of conduct, then Cornell Police is not restricted to enforce it. Our ability to enforce municipal laws is restricted by property ownership, but our campus code of conduct applies anywhere on campus. So that would sort of unmuddy that water, for lack of a better terminology. We don't have the same problem in the Cascadilla Creek Gorge. Number one, we don't have swimmers down there, really. It's really the Fall Creek. So what I've done is propose that the Codes and Judicial Committee review the wording of the city code, see if it's transmittable, transmovable to the code itself on the campus code of conduct, and see if it makes sense to put a section in there that would make it a violation to swim. That's the enforcement portion of what's going on with the safety in the gorges. There are a number of educational efforts underway. The gorge brochure, I know they're looking at redesigning that and making some more emphasis for those of you who don't have it here. Go ahead and take one and share it. There is a portion on that gorge brochure that deals with safety recommendations. There's been an effort put out that maybe change the wording of that so it's no longer a safety recommendation, but really is more emphasis, there's more emphasis on the possibility of death and dying should you violate these steps of safety regulations. Which originally, I remember, as I know, that we talked about, we didn't want to make it too scary. We don't want to have alarming alarms. So we might be at the point now where we might need to change the wording of the safety to up the level of getting people's attention. They're not just really recommendations. They're issues that are violations of which have resulted in the death and injury of others. Additionally, I know there's a group out that is looking for sort of that alternative remedy situation, trying to find places, can we make it okay to swim in the gorge? And how can we make it okay to swim in the gorge? And if not in that gorge, in perhaps another gorge, or if that's not the case, maybe something can be worked out through the city bus system to get people out to the places in the other gorges where it is permissible to swim, so there's transportation back and forth to areas where it would be reasonable and legal to swim. Then there are a couple different choices there. And then also, for long-term goals, certainly not in the second market, but looking at the campus master plan and see if it can't include some sort of creative solution of having an outdoor swimming pool on campus where, you know, it's a great place to go and hang out. So there are a number of different efforts afoot in sort of resolving what is the key issue. The key issue is it gets hot on this campus, people want to go somewhere and cool off. They think they're just going to go sit by the water. Well, then it just gets so hot they just want to go in the water. So therefore, you know, what we're looking for is a place for people who want to swim on campus to be able to in the great outdoors. That would be it by way of background, and Todd and I are both happy to answer any questions that you guys might have. I know it's kind of a preliminary thing. The Coaching Judicial Committee has not had an opportunity to meet yet. We've been trying to schedule folks together. It just hasn't happened. But I'll be the first to say I was the impetus behind bringing this forward to the Coaching Judicial Committee and have probably the best background on it anyway. Happy to be here for a great
return. Randy?
I have two questions. One. Specific. Would flat rocks be included in this?
That hasn't actually been discussed. At this point, we would have to. We're focusing on a swimming area where we have lost. We people have lost their lives.
Because I would say that's a safe zone.
Well, and that's also in the town, not
right.
In the city.
Yeah. Which there is no town ordinance against not swimming either, so it's not really. It doesn't fall under that. It's no swimming thing. It's still Cornell property, so. Or Cornell property, so I don't know how you want to do it. So I have not heard anybody mention the Flat Rock in this case. The issues that we have around Flat Rock are not generally down below where the dam area is. What the problem we have is people climb up and around that dam area, get in above it, and we almost lost a 10-year-old there not long ago. Literally, if another person hadn't been there to hold his head above the water until rescue efforts could be made to cut a log off at the top of it, we'd be a little off. So it's a dangerous area. It's posted. People aren't supposed to swim up and above the dam. They get caught in the current as it flows over the dam. There's a culvert in there. Even at the base of the dam, it's split. There's so much debris that gets caught up in there. It just sends you down and gets you tangled up in there. And certainly I've seen times where the creek has been flowing significantly enough to cause somebody to be injured, knocked off their feet. But the area above the dam in that section is of more concern than the Flat Rock area. We're specifically focusing on that swimming hole down below the suspension bridge.
So then the next question. So I think Flat Rocks is mostly safe. You have to use your head always near water, but it's mostly safe. So then the next thing that when people jump off the rocks and stuff. First of all, two chickens.
Mm-hmm.
But
you're talking about maybe like jumping off the bridge stuff?
I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
So people jump off some kind of places that they have an element of risk.
Mm-hmm.
But also an element of the best things in life are free.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to teach my kids to go to Flat Rock, so the best things in life are free instead of paying for the swimming pool. And there's some risk. There is some risk. And people have to take into consideration the risk and be smart, check what's on the bottom and all that. And how do you, you were suggesting there's maybe some alternative things to make the gorges safe. So what kind of plans are you taking that can allow some element of risk, but still within a reasonable safety?
And I don't know that we can. I think I'm just sharing with you ideas that were brought forward at other meetings that we've had to try to discuss the issue. Certainly the idea that there, in particular, once again, that swimming area that people are using illegally has an undercut which creates this eddy, which creates the dangerous situation. So there was some talk about, so you know, maybe we can get rid of the undercut, you know, blow up part of it and change the water flow, and that might stabilize that area. And similar to what they've done in areas of Treatment Park, I think, Buttermilk Falls, Park Pass, swimming areas, where they've altered the area to make it a safe area, posted lifeguards, done all those types of things. Everything costs money. That's an area where water flow is regulated, as opposed to the wild water sort of areas of the other swimming, legal swimming areas. So is this going to take hydronics engineers and people to do lots of studies, and then you're dealing with, okay, a different situation where, you know, 5 years ago, or even last year, somebody jumped in and there was a 25-foot hole down in there. Well, they didn't know that Cornell blasted and backfilled this sucker, and now it's only 5 feet deep, and they go and jump in. And now we got an injury based on what they thought was something was there.
Or if you fix it, then people think that it's okay.
Right.
And
then if it's not okay, then that we thought that, you know, we're not, we wouldn't be making any attempts to, quote, fix it, and then not allow swimming. The idea would be that if you're going to put that effort in behind it, would be in the effort to create a safer swimming area.
And somebody gets hurt, and then you're liable because you said you fixed it.
Well, again, you have to set it up similar to what the park system has done, which is it's staffed by lifeguards. There are other safety measures in place. It's going to be posted no swimming after hours, whatever the hours are going to be. I mean, it's still going to be regulated. So we're still dealing with the enforcement issue almost no matter what we do.
And let me jump in on a couple items here. One of the things, we've been looking at this issue for a while now. There really is no way with the current situation in the gorge to provide safe swimming with the physical characteristics of the gorge. You know, just putting a lifeguard out there is not by itself going to create a safe situation. It probably would result in two people dying as opposed to somebody being able to save someone. So that's really not an option. And, you know, short of changing something out there, there really is no safe alternate location that we've identified so far. That's one of the things that is on the table to try to see if there actually could be another location, not under the suspension bridge, that could provide that kind of opportunity that would be safe, but so far we haven't found any that meet that criteria. There's an important side of this that needs to be understood in terms of the use of this area. It is a natural area. It's a significant resource for education and research for Cornell. It provides scenic beauty. It's an officially recognized Tompkins County Unique Natural Areas Inventory site for these unique resources that it provides. And the stretch of Fall Creek between Beebe Lake and Cayuga Lake is designated as a recreational river from the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, and as such has additional restrictions and regulations on how it can be used and managed. It is far from a preferred alternative to go in and try to engineer a safe swimming area in this location solely on a natural areas of conservation standpoint, and not just for the river itself, but all the damage that would be related to doing that work in a location that is pretty pristine. So we're much more inclined to try the suite of efforts that Kathy was discussing about education, alternate locations, enforcement, and the like, as being the set of solutions that we're hoping come together and provide those provide those solutions that we're looking for.
Okay. You guys touched on Beebe Lake lately. Mm-hmm. Is that considered a safe area to swim?
No, it's not. I couldn't, in part, I know they used to have swimming there a long time ago. That is one of the alternative areas that they are looking at, and it's certain sections of it could be cordoned off and monitored from a, you know, like a beach perspective. Beauty Lake's kind of, you know, it's 7 feet deep and things grow in it. They'd have to do some work on it. Plus the water levels change because they do regulate water levels by the dam there. So it would involve some maintenance and whatnot. That is an area that is not at the true creek park of the Beauty Lake. Might be an area where they might look at some stuff.
You mentioned a swimming pool as a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe. Ideally, if it was a swimming in the summer, then like in the winter, it could be like turned into a skating rink, mm-hmm. perhaps outdoor ice skating.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, it costs money.
Sure, of course.
Of course.
Yeah, and that's why it's more of a long-term plan. But, you know, I remember that meeting well, sitting down and talking about it and thinking, wow, that would be so cool when you have, like, you could do, like, the, you know, Aruba swimming, you know, resort hotel things with all sorts of things to make it fun, but it didn't have to be just like, you know, the square cut,
right.
You know, chlorinated, you know, swimming laps thing, but, you know, really almost not a water park per se. I don't think anybody's going to go that far with it, but we're pretty cool, so you can do a lot of things there. A lot of fun. But that's going to take some
make money
design
on.
Work and some efforts and probably a lot of alumni community.
Yeah, a lot of money. What's been the history of loss of life or injury?
I don't. I know
recent history, but I mean over a period of 20 years, 30 years, 30 years, let's say.
One of the educational initiatives that has been discussed is a new video that would be shared with incoming freshmen in a variety of different times. And that's some of the content that we're looking to include on that educational video. And so we don't all know that answer off the top of our head, but we want to and put it on that somewhere so that people realize that it's not isolated incidents. It's not, you know, just somebody that had a little bit too much to drink, but it's, you know, a very dangerous place.
We don't mean falling off the bridge
we're talking
off the side of the gorge.
Because
those things, you know, are more
right.
I can count a few.
It
in
depends
my mind.
On the scope of what we decide mm-hmm. and which audience is targeted with what parts of the video. But you know, one of the things that was discussed was trying to suggest that people do stay on the trail, and this is more of an issue for Cascade Hill Gorge. Where there's been accidents and deaths. You know, stressing that those things happen there, please stay on the trails and be careful, and then, you know, and then the Fall Creek side as well. But we're really very much on the front end of discussions about putting those kind of things together, but we do want to have that kind of information presented.
The reason why I'm asking is that we'll be considering something you might propose to the code, should you decide to do so, about enforcement and penalties. And it would be, it's real dicey to try and decide how to patrol people's movements. If you said, you know, stepping off the trail is a code violation of the code and you have the following penalty, or putting your feet in the water is a violation of the code and you have the following penalty. It gets to be, you know, really trivialization of the code in some ways. So I'm asking about numbers because there are thousands and thousands of people that go through this campus, and we have to decide at some point that through education, we can teach them what would be, you know.
You would think, Marty, but I got to tell you, that last drowning, there were five people.
Right.
While they were dragging the body out.
Right.
While they were dragging Douglas Lowe out of that spot,
right.
There were five people who were going in. And you know, no amount of education is going to stop that. And you really got to hit the enforcement end of it. And the city code is written for basically you can't get in the water. That's the way the city code is written. I hear what you're saying about that, but Douglas Lowe was actually not swimming
right.
when he drowned.
Right.
He was waiting. He was waiting in an area that was unsafe. He slipped off the rocks. He fell into the pool.
Pool and was right there.
And so it's not just that it's unsafe to swim. It's unsafe to go in the water for many, many reasons. And that's why the code is written, the municipal code is written where it was. So the defense from the enforcement part is, you know, this is an unsafe area to be in the water in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
So that's why, yeah, to even put your feet in, to even whatever.
Well, I was thinking of in that particular place. I was thinking at a place like that, education would mean putting up a sign saying you risk a threat of death.
Right.
Well, let me add on here. Every sign that we put up gets torn down. So it's all well and good to say education. This is one of the reasons that we are working towards multiple efforts that all are aimed at the same goal, because it's hard to hang your hat on any single one as being the solution unto itself. And whether it's our trail closed signs in Cascadilla Gorge that we replaced probably 6 or 7 times this summer, as quickly as we put them up, they got torn down. You know, that was we had to close the trail. It was a public safety concern. The trail was undercut. Scared me to death walking out across it. And here we had, I mean, it was the equivalent of somebody taking out a stop sign at an intersection. And we've had the same thing happen for the trail closed signs and no swimming signs that we erected above the trail for Fall Creek. So I think it's worth a continued discussion about what the code could, how the changes could be made to the code, and whether it's prudent or not to have some parts of our trail system have an enforceable size. And right now, one of the, because we don't want to be telling people you can't hike off the trail, period, wherever our trails are. I mean, one of the main functions of the natural areas for plantation is for research and education, and so there's only so much natural area you can see from the trail. If it's illegal for everyone to hike off there, then how can they be used for education and research? But certain areas that are dangerous, it might be prudent to have the code and give a law enforcement the
as with any law, you have the opportunity for discretion in enforcement.
Right.
You know, if you had a class of 15 people that are not hanging out within, you know, 5 feet of 180-foot drop, and they're performing a class function and they're gathering fungus or whatever they're doing, you know, that they might receive a warning. They might not even be addressed. There are certain ways to get permission to do things that you might need to do. Really, what I was intending to bring to the Coastal Judicial Committee is the no swimming issue for that pool. We're talking about we have opportunities to enforce the off the trail stuff. We have opportunities to enforce going past a trail closed sign. That's a trespass, plain and simple. It's posted. Even if the sign gets stolen, they did public service announcements that were in the newspaper. They did radio announcements. They did their best to educate the public to say this area is closed. So, you know, normally it's open, yes. But again, usually if you approach someone and say, hey, this area is closed, they go, oh, sorry, they leave, there's not an issue. But you get an argument, I hike this trail every day and it's safe and I'm going to stay here, then you would have probably choose to take a different response.
I have an anecdote, and then I guess I'll go with the question first. The fence that was put up, I know I live in Fiji, so I live right where that fence is put up, and I would say probably within a couple of days of being put up, someone cut it.
I don't even know for that long.
It was probably, if even within that time frame.
Yep.
Why is, because I was also living here, not this past summer, the summer beforehand, and just looking out my window when something would happen at the gorge, you'd see the fire trucks come down and the whole thing. It's awful to watch, but why was the fence decided to be put up specifically this year? Was it just finally that like, okay, enough is enough, guys, kind of thing?
Yeah. I think there had been ideas to do it in the past, and, you know, as always, trying to do education as a first level and just saying it's dangerous and trying to keep people at the lowest level of interference, because it's not the most beautiful thing to put up on a, you know, a path that's kind of unsightly. And it was just another effort to try to get people to know this area is unsafe. Please don't go down here. Please don't swim.
And let me add this, that it was intended to be an interim step so that it provided us an opportunity to have all of these discussions and come up with a set of long-term solutions. Unfortunately, we didn't communicate it as an interim step. And, you know,
it did come out when, as soon as questions start getting asked, we communicated.
Yeah, but I mean, and every time it's been repaired, it's been cut, and so we're kind of in limbo right now about how to best deal with that situation.
My only concern, aside from kind of the natural beauty aspect of it and the idea that, you know, that I think even walking down there with no one swimming, it is quite a beautiful area, I heard a story from a few students that they had been down, they had walked through where the cut area was, and they were down there. And as they were walking back up, an officer had been securing the area and didn't let them come out, made them walk around the fence, which in my mind is much more unsafe. It seems to be counterintuitive then. And it's just kind of little things like that bother me a little bit almost. It seems to be the safety versus fun thing.
I can hear what you're saying. Probably wouldn't have been my first choice, but I also don't know what the interaction was.
So maybe just, I guess, to underscore the idea of better communication between perhaps the two organizations and just kind of...
I'm going to pose out, how did they get down there in the first place? They went through a hole in a fence that somebody cut that was posted, obviously not to go through. So did they walk past the officer and say, well, he didn't stop us from doing this, or did the officer say, no, I'm not opening this up for you, no way, go right here. Really was the interaction? That's really what my concern is. So. Rebecca?
I mean, no disrespect by this, but I'm going to state the obvious a little bit. I mean, all of these measures have been in place. People know there are deaths in the gorge. The fence was pretty obvious. People carry on these signs. I don't really think that any of these measures, no matter how we enforce them, are really going to stop students from swimming in the gorge.
They're never going to stop it. I agree.
Even if we put in a swimming pool. So how about another option? How have we looked into making it an actual safe swimming area? I mean, nothing can replace it. Even if Cornell erected the nicest pool there was, swimming in the gorges would still be beautiful. It would still be, you know, cool and fun. So what other options do we have? Have we looked into making this a safe area?
This would kind of just touch on it.
Let me add this, too. At a recent student organization was formed to look into some of the concerns and provide feedback, and I encourage everyone to participate with that group if they want to. It's called Friends of the Gorge. Marion Krasny is the advisor, and right now a lot of the educational initiatives that we're talking about they're working on, so we welcome all the participation we can get. At one of our initial meetings, Sergeant Scott Salino, came and basically relayed to he is a university officer. He is on the search and rescue team and has been down several times to the swimming hole below the suspension bridge. And I cannot do it justice. He relayed his experience of being down there. And everyone was riveted. It had the hair standing up on the back of my neck as he described being down in this basically hellhole of a place as safe as anybody could be, tethered to the surface with the rescue personnel at the surface in communication with them with microphones and earpieces, scuba gear. You know, I mean, you really can't have a better equipped situation. And he was being absolutely pummeled down there, smashed up against the rocks, hardly could move. There was tree roots, shopping carts, dead animals, rock crevices. And he said it was the most scary experience he ever had in his life. And here he is, you know, not just an ordinary swimmer in that situation. And one of the problems with trying to make it safe is that it changes every minute, every day. It's different. It could be safe 9 days out of 10, and then a rain half county away changes the flow and doubles the volume of water coming down, or shifts the rocks that are down there, or moves trees and branches and root balls around. And you know, short of some you know, enormous engineering effort that would have very serious and negative environmental ramifications, it would be very difficult to engineer that place into a viable swimming pool. So, and I don't even know that it could be done and still be safe. And that's economics aside. So, we're focusing on trying to come up with ways that are alternatives to that. And you know, I that could change, but you know, it just seems that that's in everyone's best interest right now.
And just from your wording, it sounds like that's not really something that you guys are interested in pursuing. Is that correct? I mean,
I would say that aside from that, that's the final statement. But don't misinterpret how long people have been looking at this. This has been years that people look at it. Very, very concentrated in the last year, I would say. But it has been years. It's always been an idea. It's always been an option out there. Well, what can we do? What can't we do? And this year, I think it's all, as somebody said, this is kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. This is, now we've really got to make some decisions, move forward on some alternatives. Really, what we've tried in the past is not working, and that's why we've got to try to open it up. So it's not like we had one meeting, decided that wasn't an option, and moved on. There have been countless meetings.
I know that there are state falls, and I mean, I understand that there are obviously, you know, environmental ramifications for actions, but, I mean, I would definitely hope that we look into that option as much as possible, because I value the lives of students over, you know, animals and trees.
Well, you know, like I said, one of the things that we're looking at is, instead of trying to engineer a solution, is to see if there's an alternate location that we can get people to be able to have that kind of experience, but have it be safe. And that, you know, would be more the win-win situation. But it's, again, the unpredictable nature of that. It's the largest river system that feeds into Cayuga Lake. It has the largest watershed, and so it's going to have, you know, enormous fluctuations in flow, and that's just one of the complicating factors, you know, that make it entirely different than Buttermilk Falls or some of the other favorite swimming places that are a little more predictable.
Oh, I didn't have a question. I just had a comment. I don't know if anybody's looked at the university budget recently, but I know that we just reallocated $300 million that was supposed to go to facilities to program support and financial aid and faculty support. Olin, in which a million people pass through every year, doesn't have adequate life support systems. So I think in terms of university priorities, there's much more of a risk of loss of life in Olin Library than, you know, Gordon said, for, you know, students have been educated that, you know, swimming is dangerous. So I, you know, it's a nice idea, but if you look at the big picture, you know, through 2012, I don't really think that this is, I mean, the cost of that engineering project, I think, is just not anybody's priority. So.
I would like to bring this to a close so they can venture on.
And okay. Actually, I think we as an assembly could say that we look forward to considering a resolution from the PJC so we can discuss it further with you all. And it sounds to me like the PJC would be thinking, and you together with them.
They said that, you know, that right now what I'm bringing forward is very narrow focus.
Right.
A lot of things we're talking about have a much broader focus.
Right.
And I'd like to volunteer at least a next step. Perhaps we consider. I think, well, I'll speak for myself, but I think it would be wonderful to consider perhaps not multi-billion dollar projects of engineering, which would be wonderful, but perhaps not practical or likely.
to consider what we did with the sustainability initiative in the first place, and that is get out the message. It's very inexpensive to hold a lecture or a presentation of somebody who's been there, done that, and actually lived to tell about it. So those kinds of stories are very powerful when you look at things like drunk driving initiatives and, you know, how to get people to stop using alcohol. Go to the basics. You know, how do you get people educated? You go into their practice, how business really happens. You go into their program, join them, and you talk to them about it. You make up slides and presentations and get them to use it back then and say, here's an alternative to how to not be so dangerous.
Right, with this, we're trying to have the alternative to present, because right now it feels like all we can do is yank away the fun. So we are trying to build that educational piece at the same time, saying, you know, here's where you can swim, it's beautiful, it is a gorge, yes, it's a hike, but, you know.
It'll help you get out your message. You've got the GPSA, the SA, Faculty Senate, Employee Association,
I know the University Communication is working. That's kind of their piece, and they have that information, and they have that target goal of how do we broadly reach. It's not just the video loop for incoming freshmen. There's an outreach that's going to be a little more.
Mark or Asa, does the Student Assembly have a group working on this too, and are they looped into this? Kathy's group or
I think that's what I was speaking of. That's the group that we've
been we actually held our official first meeting. I sent out an email on the website to everyone. We invited all the friends of the Gorges, and we're looking to continued work and collaboration between them with our contacts and resources through the administration. And basically the major factor we're going to be focusing on is one, education, as well as different things such as orientation for incoming students, different possibilities for busing and other programs. So I'm working on getting minutes printed up from the last meeting. I will re-invite everyone to our next meeting, and most likely all the friends of the Gorge will be there, individuals. And then this is where we're going to be tailoring. We have started the education part, and we're looking to finish that as we go through the rest of the semester, so that by next year, by next orientation, by hopefully the summer when people start going out, we have something in place working in conjunction with the University Communications to respond to this. So it is in progress, and I will keep everyone up to date as to what we do.
It's just as a general aside, I was recently at Niagara Falls, and I don't know if anybody's been up there, and I just got a big kick out of the fact that, you know, here is this gushing river with these white caps and, you know, 6 foot high waves that is just the other side of a 2.5 foot tall stone, much like the railing in the College Ave bridge, with then a little bit of steel on top. Right on top, like every 20 feet, there's a little sign of a person that appears to be climbing over the wall, a big circle with a red flash through it. Like, don't climb over the wall. They still have to tell people. This is Niagara Falls. This is the biggest, you know, tourist attraction that, you know, you still have to tell people. I actually took a picture of the sign. Maybe you'll see some up here. They might need a beer. I know we're never going to stop everything. We all know that we're never going to stop. There are risk takers out here. We all know it. However, we're trying to influence the greater group of, I just didn't know. And had I known, I would have acted differently.
But also to have, if somebody doesn't care, out there with a couple of people who do care, they might act on their behalf and say, that's not a good idea.
Right.
And that's where we want to get going. To have, there's always probably going to be somebody out there at some point in time to get them to help you spread that message.
Yep.
Just a quick thing on top of that. One thing in discussion is creating a volunteer group of students, such as myself, that knew Doug, such as other people that have, you know, made that vow saying, you know, I'm not going back in there. And specifically during orientation and during programs, or during June or the beginning of April when it starts to get warm, we would work with university police to not necessarily, you know, arrest people or do whatever, but sort of educate.
We're doing that same sort of head of the trailhead,
wearing yellow shirts,
right,
and things like that nature. So we're working towards that to get that established.
I have to say there's been a lot of focused minds on this and a lot of great out-of-the-box ideas that have come forward, and this is not something where, you know, people just say, oh, this is still offensive, I don't walk away. Enforcement is a part of that tool, but as I said, what we're looking for right now is a particularly dangerous area the focus is on that. It's not on Flat Rock. I don't think there's even any intent. Like I said, there's not a municipal code preventing you from being in Flat Rock. So it's more of a trespass situation when we're talking about the town. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this up today. Let's go back to the reports from constituent assemblies.
As brief as possible.
Briefly, like
briefly.
3-4 minutes at most.
Start with the essay.
Sure. So, Reed, Mike and I can sort of work together. Some things we were discussing this week in the essay and this past week, we're reviewing SAFC, Student Assembly Finance Commission, funding groups, the different groups that have been brought towards the assembly or to the commission. Pretty much since our last meeting, that was what those sort of initiatives, there's not been nothing really to report necessarily on that level. But we are working towards that, and we are having a meeting tomorrow.
Okay. GPSA?
At our last meeting, we talked a little bit about the amethyst issue. We talked about pros and cons. We talked about whether the GPSA should take any kind of action on that. We basically sent it back to our student advocacy committee that should be meeting on that. I think our next meeting is November 10th, and they'll present a report back to the GPSA on whether we should take a resolution on that, what we should do about it, make some recommendations. A lot of our last meetings have that's kind of the focus of our past meeting and our next meeting coming up. And then we had a basic review from our ad hoc charter review committee.
I just have one more thing to add. I think our advocacy committee is very active, and they're trying to include all the different satellite locations. So they're adding, at their next meeting, they have a webcast for the GPSA.
EA?
You know what, because Bill was here at 6 a.m. and I arrived at 6:30 on Monday, I'll let you share.
Well, our big focus obviously has been the president's address to staff and the energy fair, which did take place Monday. That's been taking most of the effort and focus of the EA. It did go off well, and now I think outside of Lee and I, the rest of them are probably home sleeping, and we're going to try and regroup and start focusing on other activities.
Faculty Senate?
Not to report.
That was quick. campus planning.
It's just a wonderful group of people from all aspects of life that you would never even think of that comes together to see how the campus should be built. So, for example, there's a new addition that may be put on the Goldman Smith, the new humanities center. And in order to fit in that part of campus, some portion of it will be underground. So there's somebody there that's worried about wireless communication underground. And so there's just so many different people from all walks of life that are asking all kinds of questions about cost, beauty, particularly sustainability, and all aspects. And it's a wonderful community to be a part of. There's three buildings that are going up. The Plantations Welcome Center, the Humanities Building on Goldman Smith, which is between the current building and the street, and you may have seen the side of the hotel's school. There's a fly wall in there behind this auditorium, which will now have a glass enclosure. And the last thing that they're working on is the quad in the ILR school. Make it as green, sustainable, and functional as possible. And they're always looking for input from people, and great.
What do you guys need?
I'll email you that.
Can you email me?
I'll.
What's that?
You need to.
Yeah.
Okay.
You may know that. We're talking about campus planning. Right?
Yeah.
Is it campus planning? Okay.
Oh, actually, I'm not. I'm just the lady.
Okay.
Ren, could you comment on so this? Let's talk about sustainability. Is it your sense that it being the group is being relatively hard-nosed about its commitment, the university's commitment to actual numbers like zero carbon footprint and so on, or is it more superficial than that at this stage?
I think what's happening with sustainability at Cornell is a model, and I think they're looking for input from everyone, truly from everybody. Whether they'll use any input, or you can't use all the input, but I think they're generally seeking input for two reasons: to get the best things to happen, and secondly, anybody that gives input will come involved and implement the program. And I think it's a real core commitment. I don't think it's they're particularly looking to get the platinum medal, the gold medal. I mean, that's part of it, but I think it's more of a core commitment. Where we're going to go, that they really think that there's a sufficient number of people that feel that that's the best way to go for so many reasons.
But I guess I'm wondering if for example, from the commissions and so on that they put together on sustainability, whether there are guidelines that can be considered while thinking about a specific project that might, for example, even tell you that you should that the project itself is so unsustainable, the associated Caterpillar machines for 12 months that are going to be running, that it will never pay itself off. So you consider not even doing it as a project.
They consider everything. And have you been to the website?
Mm-hmm.
So www.cornell.edu/sustainability. And I'm not sure quite what's up there, but they have all these wedges and various terms that they're talking about to take into consideration the things that you're talking about. And for example, the atrium, the roof of the New Humanities Center may be made of glass, which wouldn't be particularly energy efficient, but the fact that it's underground will make up for some part. And they're really trying to balance and cast a huge net to come to a reasonable decision. I have faith in that.
Well, in that regard, there was we had a presentation at the leadership, Assembly's leadership breakfast by John Kiefer, who's the director of facilities and
planning design,
construction, and it was about projects that had been completed on campus and or were in the course of being completed. And I think Abe is asking reasonable questions. In the sense that it is true the university is putting a lot of energy and publicity into its efforts to do this, and it is true that some efforts have paid off remarkably well, but it is also true that there are areas in which its conduct and plans are completely unsustainable, and when they're put to the test, it would be shown to be that way. And it's worthwhile raising that as much as you sort of with desire to the university when it comes to place. And speaking along those lines, I just wanted to say that Mr. Kiefer, in comparison, to give you an example, they just completed Wild Hall, this marvelous lab facility. And lab facilities are notoriously difficult to construct, either cost efficiently or with sustainability, or in compliance with different green goals. And they shot for silver leads, and they got gold because, and the cost per square foot was $400 for construction, $200 for pre-construction, per square foot, which means $600 per square foot, which is a remarkably low cost, because the architects from the university worked very hard to get a sustainable green building in a laboratory circumstance, and they were able to do that because they actually put thought and effort into it. In contrast, the pre-production for the not yet built extension of the apartment architecture building called Milstein Hall, pre-production is already $400 per square foot pre-production. The projected construction cost is $1,000 per square foot. The total cost is $1,400 per square foot, just projected cost. The building is only LEED compliant, which is the lowest possible LEED level, and it hasn't even been built. And when asked why couldn't it be projected as LEED Silver, it said, well, it's grandfathered in at the lower level, when we already had a building that was built with gold level. Now, I obviously have got emotionally involved in this. These are all facts, so my emotion is only designed to tell you facts. I suggest that these are just unexamined points that are being slipped through, which it seems to me worthwhile to bring out the way Abe has suggested one should, and it may well happen in several places around the university. It's worthwhile bringing them out. The leadership record showed you several other things, and there were very nice things like the new heat recovery steam, fabulous thing, the chilled water plant, the fabulous development. Now, one of the things to consider is that current projected cost of the Milstein is about $50 million. There's a gift involved, and we've made well equal half of the amount. It's right now presently only one-tenth of the amount. But still, that means $25 million is being spent on this building out of university resources. That $25 million is going towards an unsustainable, high cost per square foot building. One imagines better could be done. Thanks.
No, thank you.
Because I was under the impression that everything had to be silver plus 30%. So
it's grandfathered. Grandfathered in at the low setting. It's grandfathered in as LEED compliant. In other words, when asked, and somebody asked Mr. Kiefer at the meeting, well, why isn't it LEED, at least LEED silver? And he said, because the agreement to build the building took place before the trustees voted that LEED silver plus 30% or whatever is what he wanted to do. Now, the question would be, this building is completed at LEED gold.
Right. That, and the other one has
so what is, the grandfather is not yet born.
Right.
In that sense.
Right. I'll ask about that.
Thank you.
Leanne, did you have a question?
I did, but I'll pass.
Okay. Anybody? Rebecca?
First of all, I wanted to know, have we looked at any projections of what it would cost to make this building sustainable? I mean, I'm sure that there's some reason it's projected to cost $1,400 per square foot. I mean, that sounds like an incredible figure. Do we know why it's so much higher than, for instance, for this lab? Is it?
Have to ask the architect.
Okay. I wanted to know if you knew. And then I also have to know with regard to the extension on...
I do know, but you'd have to ask the architect.
Oh, okay. with regard to the extension on Golden Smith, how much of a commitment has been made to sort of making sure that it looks like it was initially part of the building and, you know, not like it's just some new piece that's been plopped down in the middle? I mean, is it going to be a situation like Ives Hall or like the West Campus Initiative.
They would like it to be more like, I think, Lincoln Hall, in terms of how they built up to the street and it looks like part of the building. I think one of they realize it's one of the most prime pieces of real estate on campus, and making it look good is the higher their priority list. And they have the first draft right now. And they kept, I forget what it's called, that little round thing that comes out. It's hard to the back, but I do like it that way. And and they had a glass top in order to keep that part of the architecture. And there's not that much space between the building.
It was the livestock pavilion many years ago when the whole university was situated on the arts quad. That half, the semicircular section on the east side of Golden Smith was actually a livestock pavilion.
So it continues with a bolt.
So there's a lot of history.
Isn't that also...
I'm on history.
That's also historical, the actual quad, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know about that building.
And the reason they want to build underground is to not take anything away, but hopefully add.
Okay.
But feel free to come to the meeting.
Yeah.
From our leadership breakfast, John Kiefer gave us a handout of what was happening, and I'm going to have Amy try and get a copy of that from him so I can send it out to the list, because it's really interesting and very informative.
But there's also a transcription of the talk, isn't that right, Amy?
No, Ari usually does that, and he wasn't able to make the last.
But somebody sent around a note saying that Kiefer's talk is available at the following website.
I don't know. We can check.
I know. That. I think it was from your office. That's why I brought it up. Let me look and see.
Well, we'll look into it, Marty.
Okay.
Yeah,
this is something different. Piggybacking on Marty and Keith at the leadership breakfast.
Yeah.
I've seen him do that presentation too, and I'm just wondering, Marty, is that a presentation perhaps that he could do for the UA? Would it be evaluated at the UA?
Isn't that what we had in mind?
I thought so.
You had proposed that that's what he would do.
Yeah, I was...
Or Delgado. Or Delgado, isn't that the... Who's the university architect?
Gilbert. Delgado.
Yeah.
Gilbert.
Because we were going to tie that in the spring.
Was it spring or was it fall? Well, you go.
Yeah.
Well, anyway. Well,
we can invite him. If everybody is interested, we'll invite them. Let's move on to Seth. I believe we'll have an update for us on Gannett.
Yeah. It's going to be a brief update.
That's okay.
The minutes from the last discussion they had about what to do with the DHS, the
Board on
University Health Services.
And it was a long discussion about its usefulness. Generally, I'll give you the quick sum of the minutes from 2004 and sort of the direction on where conversations led up to and then died. In particular, the board, as it was designed as a standing committee of the university assembly, had a charge that was so broad it could not possibly meet its responsibility as a standing committee. It was composed of 15 members from across the university, including the community at large, plus including 6 alternates, and a university assembly liaison. As such, there were so many people to deal with a board that had such a broad range of activities and responsibilities that people lost interest, nobody could keep track of the topics, people who were not up to speed on a particular agenda item or topic of importance, didn't have anything to contribute, and the communications back then between the different assemblies was very poor. And has since been addressed in the last 4 years, 5 years. In particular, connections between just the major assemblies here, the university assembly, to the GPSA, the SAEA, everything. There are still a variety of issues that need to be addressed, but the Health Services Committee then got renamed, and I know I'm not giving the actual names of these things correctly, but the Health Services, University Health Services cluster got renamed as Gannett, and Gannett started establishing its own boards to address various issues such as health, occupational medicine requirements, substance use and abuse and things like that. And they were addressing those things, but whatever was being discussed wasn't being communicated back to the different assemblies, and communication just got lost. The assembly, the board in and of itself broke down and never really accomplished anything that it was charged to do. So what do we do now? Where we're going with this right now is to propose an amendment through a resolution to strike from the university assembly charter the BUHS as a standing committee and replace it with just a university liaison, the way that we have set up with our other committees. The idea is to have a very distinct line of communication between UA and the Health Services Committee, and it's one person from here that goes to meet with Gannett whenever they meet, and whoever else is a part of the Gannett conversation, Gannett will organize to have them come, and the notes that get discussed in that meeting come from that university assembly liaison back to the university assembly. Whatever we want to do, we discuss here, and then whenever that liaison goes back to that meeting, they can communicate back what's going on, and you have a very one person that goes back and forth. You don't have 6 graduate students, 7 undergraduate students, 9 community members, and et cetera, that have to staff a committee in order to get votes done, in order to pass resolutions. That in and of itself is very unproductive. Ari sent me a draft that I looked at for resolution on what to do regarding the change to our charter. And I can read it, summarize it for you guys if you're interested, and then specifically show where the changes would be in the charter. But I gotta say, I'm not prepared to propose this as a resolution because I have to talk to Sharon first. I wanna know her feedback on everything that I just shared with you before I say, here's our next step.
And everybody knows who Sharon. I know who she is. Everybody knows.
She's the director.
She's the director of health services.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still learning the players involved in this conversation. I have only communicated with her on email. There's still a lot of loose ends that I myself have to tie together before I can come here and say, here's exactly who's involved and what their responsibilities were and where the communication down, but that in a nutshell, what I already put on at the discussion floor right now is what I understand is a pretty good summary of what happened up to 2004 and then since 2004 and where we are likely to go next and what we're going to do about the future. Thank you. So,
I know too, Sharon was very open to coming to meetings as this was discussed to help work through a more realistic solution than what we have now in our brief conversations, that she's more than happy to come, and it might be helpful to have Sharon in the room here as a resolution is discussed.
Absolutely,
well.
And that's exactly what I'm going to talk with her about. So and specifically, having this resolution draft in front of me, when I meet with Sharon, I'm just going to confirm with her what I understand. Do I have the right understanding of what has happened and where I think we're talking about going? And then I'll say, what do you think of the resolution? Do you have any changes? I have some amendments, some changes to this that I wanted to talk with her about. And then when we're prepared, I will discuss certainly to bring it up again on the agenda. It'll certainly be before the end of the semester to say, here's what we discussed. Here's the resolution that we're proposing for a vote to the University Assembly. And I will certainly make sure that we schedule it at a time when Sharon's available. Participate in the conversation and discussion.
I think that would be good.
Okay. So it, what you just described is the history of this committee. If I'm understanding, it's very similar to many of the committees that are associated with the UA that are originally designed to deal with something that under usual conditions the administrative unit deals with very effectively by themselves. And so having lots of community input is just cumbersome and difficult to sustain in standard years. And what you're proposing is that we, in the charter for this period, collapse this down to a much simpler relationship to the UA. It would seem like, well, if we're going to do it for this one, we might do it for a number of others. But I'd argue that maybe that's not a good idea, because I've been involved in a committee that I suspect in a few years will be almost completely dormant with HR, but that right now we have lots of people who are interested in being involved in, because there are pressing issues, and we have a structure that allows people to be involved. So I wouldn't want to see that in a few years the child care committee get collapsed down to a single liaison to HR, because then in 10 years, when HR is going to be opening its next child care center, we then have to recreate the structure that accommodates 3 grad student members, so on. So that's
Peggy.
Let me just respond, and then you can see if you have more that you'd like to add. Some of the changes that I want to talk to Sharon about before I actually put this to a vote here at the University Assembly include specifically what are the consequences of removing the UHS as a standing committee. And as such, is the alternative that we're proposing really any different than having it as a standing committee and really just recognizing the UA liaison as the point person for the University Assembly and leaving Gannett with the responsibility or University Health Services group as a committee to be responsible for getting the people to staff it, you know, and putting out the call to the GPSA to get the 5 graduate students, putting out the call to the University Assembly to get however many people they need from there, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
And because it doesn't really, right now, the way that this is written doesn't sound any differently to me than the way it's already.
But still has the possibility of bringing representatives from all parts of the
district. Right. But what we want to do is to make it perhaps simply in just the language with which it's described in the charter, more concise and specific, so that when people read it, they go, oh, that seems really simple. And not thinking, gosh, we have to find 15 people from all these different assemblies and all at the same time, which is really what you need to do in order to have something like this function in its capacity. So there are still a lot of things that we need to talk about. One consideration that I had thinking outside of the box is that perhaps an alternative, if we test this as a standing committee as it's written in the charter, would be to give it the authority to be more fluid in its constituency. To say, if you don't have a fully staffed committee, that the respective assembly, like the graduate assembly or the student assembly, could just volunteer what they could volunteer, and at that semester's mark, when they put the committee together, if they have 3 grads instead of 6 grads, that would be sufficient, and they vote with a quorum of who gets put into the committee as is at the beginning of the semester. Just a suggestion.
Peggy?
So I'll try to be brief. And this is particular to University Health Services. To your question, I think it was about representation. Really, University Health Services went beyond what was available to them with a very limited scope, with a small committee that was the Health Services, and they actually grew it, and so they have whole groups of committees with the appropriate representation from all the constituents, and a great example of that is President's Council on Alcohol and Other Drugs. There is representation from across campus, and they are delving into the issues that are related to that area. And that was one of the problems with this Board on Health Services. They didn't have the depth and knowledge and bandwidth to really delve into what were becoming bigger and bigger issues on campus, these health issues. TAP, psych services, is another area that, again, there is a large group that's well represented. And I think the Gannett does not wish to sever ties with this group, far from that. They wish to be engaged and continue with it, but more in a reporting way, in an information way, so you are aware of what they're doing and what they're working on, and offer to you the opportunity to say, hey, we think this is important and a priority, or we have suggestions for that. So there still is that consultation and that legislative authority that is delegated to you by the, from the president, that you still maintain that. But it's almost impossible to ask a group like this to create a board on health services that's doing the work of probably five different councils that are out there doing really great work. So that's kind of where we're, that's what Sharon would say, where she is.
And in the interest of time, just to sort of take what she said and put it very simply, can I draw a picture on this little draw board here?
Sure. No, you can't draw a picture. And this is actually probably going to tie really well into our next subject, which is charter review.
Currently, the VUHS is charged with doing all the things regarding health services all off, okay? But what has happened is because it was so broad, the scope of the responsibility was so broad, and it wasn't being effective at all because it was so broad, the university went ahead and created these committees on alcohol or, you know, cabs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And essentially what I think Sharon and I are going to end up talking about is to lead these committees that were created that are functioning very well as is. And BUHS will not be reconstituted necessarily the way it was originally designed to be addressing all of these things from here, but instead to have liaisons from these different committees that already work go to the BUHS, talk amongst themselves about what they're addressing in their individual committees, and then you and Jess will have liaisons that go out to the UH, PSA, SA, etc. And it's just a hub of liaisons that are coming together at a specific point in time and having the communication go from maybe that's talking about the specific issue to a centralized place to get back out to where it needs to go to have resolution pass and action happen. Very clear. So we're creating a traffic light, a four-way stop sign where people can come together, meet, greet, and get the information back out where it needs to go.
Four-way stop.
Okay, we'll look forward to more information from you on that. Now going to Charter Review Committee.
Put that down to see if anything has been since our last meeting.
Probably hasn't, because I forget to send an email.
Well, then.
I signed up for that. That was my fault. I've been quite busy with it.
I also signed up for it, too, but I have actually talked with Amy, and I've asked her to contact all of us, also including Ari and Peggy, to be a part of the Charter Review Committee. We will.
Could you do that?
Mm-hmm.
Could you arrange a meeting?
I know.
But I'm just asking you formally.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I've been busy with pre-enrollment since it started last week.
To check all our calendars and work together.
Amy will, said she will do that. Any other late items you could want to talk about? Updates?
There's something, actually. I mean, this is an idea that I'm personally working on, and I just always find it useful to have a sounding board. There's a group within the State Department known as the International Visitors Program, and what they allow for is our government or sometimes foreign governments fund visitors to come to the United States to learn about our education system, our way of life, our government, just a whole slew of issues. I worked with this during the summer, actually, specifically through the Justice Department, and I'm looking right now to make Cornell more active, or actually active, in this program. where we could start having international visitors come at, not Cornell's expense, but at the government's expense or a foreign government's expense, to Cornell to learn about our education system. Specifically, I think that'd be the most kind of pertinent issue. Really, a whole, I think, range of things could be applicable. I had a meeting with Susan Murphy yesterday about this, and she seemed to think this was a good idea. My next step is getting involved in the NGO that actually facilitates this. I'm just curious, kind of, people's thoughts about this, I guess.
Would this be like a, not like an extension thing?
It's foreign officials, NGO officials, not students, really. They come to the United States. They're, let's say, in Washington for a couple days. They're on the West Coast for a couple days. And let's say they want to stop by Cornell for a couple days. And we would, me and the other people who are involved in it, could put together programs where they meet certain faculty, maybe perhaps open forums with students, just things, dialogues like that, that I think they call it citizen diplomacy, I guess, if you want to use that term. I think it's something that would be extremely beneficial. There are about 7 other schools that currently do this, UC Davis, Montana State, I don't remember the other ones, to be honest. I don't know, this to me is something I'm interested in, so I kind of just...
Mark, did Susan suggest that you talk to Provost Alan Pell, who is international relations?
No.
I think that might be a good idea. They're often, she's right here in the building.
I've actually been in contact with Stephen Johnson, too, and
That would be government.
He expressed interest as well, and he said that was something, so I've been thinking
about that. Dallas is the Associate Provost for International Relations, so I think it would be a good area to at least talk to as you're thinking about this.
Great, thank you.
Item from the floor, do we want to approve minutes?
Yeah. She just reminded me I forgot to do that.
Oh, okay. Everybody ready?
Let's do minutes of the last meeting.
Alright, I'll second.
So Katie firsted and Mark seconded. Everybody approve?
Vote.
Everybody vote? Yay or nay?
Yay.
All those in favor.
All those in favor. And it looks good to me. Do you want to give an update? Randy, do you want to give an update on people's thoughts?
Right now we are in the process of getting survey results from Susan Murphy's office. We should be getting that within the week. From the survey they compiled, fortunately, ad drops seemed to have gone well yesterday, so that's good. It was only a quarter of the students that were involved last time, so I don't know what kind of indicator that is necessarily, but so far so good. So when we get those surveys...
Oh, compared to ad drop.
Yeah, because to compare to ad drop, it's the quantity. But when we get those, we'll be sharing them with the body. So.
Do we know at all with regard to the glitches? I mean, I was registering using someone else's slot during senior enrollment, and it was not good. I mean, it wasn't as bad as last year, but it was by no means convenient or easy, or it didn't flow well. Will those problems still be present in the juniors, not for the freshmen enrollment?
It's hard to say because, personally, I haven't. I don't know exactly. I would assume that they're working out kinks, as they said that they are, kind of constantly. Because every time they run the entire thing, they kind of learn small tweaks, sort of. So hopefully, they said they are. We'll see.
I can vouch for that, since that's my office, and I support that. We're constantly making changes. Constantly. And everything's being looked at 5 times over. So...
Could you speak about the 19th meeting?
Actually, we're going to cancel. We decided, the executive committee group decided to cancel the November 12th meeting. And to meet on the 19th. And scheduled for the 19th is Climate Neutrality Committee, Sustainability, and a potential few minutes on SA elections.
Yeah, Mike McDermott will be coming and giving us a small brief, very short minutes.
And And what is the climate neutrality sustainability program? What do you have?
We've been considering a few groups. Transportation, we were going to bring. We were considering.
And Dean. Koinaka.
They're available. They're available for the 19th.
We are in the process of.
Okay. If they're not, what would we do?
I would be interested in, if we can't get them, to see if we can get John Kiefer to come. Because that might be, relate into that also, as far as sustainability and campus buildings coming up.
How about Bert Lance?
Who's Bert Lance?
Bert Lance.
Oh, Bert Lance?
He actually reports to Bert now, so that's what he says.
John Kiefer does?
No.
Dean
reports to Bert Lance.
He's the new
environmental compliance officer. Yeah. So he could talk about the 2040 action plan as well.
Okay. We'll check into that.
It might be nice to have somebody from planning and design together with sustainability, because that's putting one and one together.
Okay.
Yeah. Planning, design, construction, they changed their name. It's project.
Project.
Instead of planning.
Right.
It's project.
Project design.
Right. And the... Okay. Right. Project design.
So the planning office is under the university architect at the Edmonton's office.
Right.
In a different area. Administrative.
Right.
Because I know that stuff.
But it should be a good meeting. Somebody like to. Yeah. Thank you.
All in favor.
Sorry, I'm not with it today.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.